This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Donald Trump apparently tweeting about Paul Manafort. Oh, jeez. This is a guy who will sit there with members of the press and say, the Democrats passed this law requiring us to tear children from their families at the border, knowing that it's a lie. There is no such law. But he's trying to basically blackmail the Democrats into funding the border wall by saying, you know, we'll pass a law against it if you include funding the border wall. Right? I mean, but he's lying to the reporters. They know he's lying. He knows he's lying. They challenge him on the lie. I think it was Kristen Welker, if I'm remembering her name correctly, the reporter for NBC News, who said, no, you're the president. You can do it by executive order. For that matter, I mean, it doesn't even take that. All it takes is Jeff Sessions saying, we're going to go back to the old policy. You know, the policy that we had before May. You know, this has just been, you know, federal policy for 6-8 weeks, something like that. This is a Trump administration policy. This guy would just lie to their face. And, you know, as I shared with you, the FDR had something to say about that. But anyhow, I mentioned in the last hour, as we were coming into this hour, that I just read the dissent of Sonia Sotomayor in the case of John Husted, or however he says it, Ohio Secretary of State petitioner versus A. Philip Randolph Institute et al. And basically what this Supreme Court case said was that the Secretary of State may now send you a postcard that looks like a piece of junk mail. And if you don't return that postcard saying, yes, I'm me and I want to keep voting, they can take you off the voting rolls. Now, the National Voting Rights Act, there's two pieces of legislation here that are of consequence in this case. And you need to understand how this works, because the solution comes out of an understanding of how it works. The National Voting Rights Act, which was passed back in the 1960s, says that no state can remove you from the voting rolls simply for not voting. There has to be evidence that you are no longer at that address or have moved or have died, right? You know, there has to be some evidence of that before you can be removed from the voting list, or you've lost your right to vote. You know, in some states, felons lose the right to vote. That's it. But then the Help America Vote Act in 2002, this was the Republican-sponsored legislation. Bob Ney, in fact, helped write it. At the time, he thought he was doing the right thing. It certainly hasn't turned out that way. The Help America Vote Act says that a state, that there are things that a state may engage in to find out if a person is still in that state or not. It basically opened a loophole to get around the National Voting Rights Act. And this is what Sonia Sotomayor said. I'm just going to read to you some parts from her dissent. This is a 5-4 decision. The 5 right-wingers said, great, states start mailing out those postcards. And by the way, Republican states are doing it as we speak. Start mailing out those postcards so that you can start stripping people off the voting rolls. And this is happening in Republican states. The 5 right-wingers on the Supreme Court, along with the illegitimate right-winger on the Supreme Court, who should have been Merrick Garland, said, yeah, go ahead, go for it, right? Neil Gorsuch and the whole crowd of them. And the 4 democratically appointed, that is appointed by a Democrat, Democratic president, members of the court, who are sometimes referred to as liberals, I'm not sure I would apply that label to Stephen Breyer. He's a middle-of-the-road guy. I mean, he's, you know, but nonetheless, dissented. And this is from Sotomayor's dissent. She said Congress enacted the National Voting Rights Act against the backdrop of substantial efforts by the states to disenfranchise, in other words, take away the vote from, low-income and minority voters, including programs that purged eligible voters from registration lists because they failed to vote in prior elections. The court errs, in other words, this is why she's objecting to this 5-4 decision. The court errs in ignoring this history and distorting the statutory text. In other words, she's saying her colleagues, her five Republican colleagues, are actually lying to us and distorting the statutory text to arrive at a conclusion that not only is contrary to the plain language of the National Voting Rights Act, but also contradicts the essential purposes of that statute, ultimately sanctioning the very purging that Congress expressly sought to protect against back in the 1960s. And then she quotes from one of her earlier dissents, this one in Schuette versus Bam, quote, "In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a number of restrictive registration laws and administrative procedures came to use across the United States. States enforced poll taxes, literacy tests, residency requirements, selective purges, and annual registration requirements, which were developed to keep certain groups of citizens from voting. Particularly relevant here," writes Sonia Sotomayor, "some states erected procedures requiring voters to renew registrations, quote, whenever they moved or failed to vote in an election, which sharply depressed turnout, particularly among blacks and immigrants," end quote. "Even after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, many obstacles remained." She says Congress was well aware of the long history of such cleaning mechanisms, which have been used to violate the basic rights of citizens when it enacted the National Voting Rights Act. Ohio's supplemental process, in other words, the supplement is, hey, we're going to mail out a postcard. Ohio's supplemental process reflects precisely the type of purge system that the National Voting Rights Act was designed to prevent. Under the supplemental process, Ohio will purge a registrant from the polls after 6 years of not voting. In other words, sitting out one presidential election and two midterms, and after failing to send back one piece of mail, even though there's no reasonable basis to believe that that individual actually moved. This purge program burdens the rights of eligible voters. At best, purged voters are forced to needlessly re-register if they decide to vote in a subsequent election. At worst, they are prevented from voting at all because they never receive information about when and where the elections are taking place. And then she points out that the right-wingers on the court are doing this for basically partisan purposes. They want to keep low-income voters off the voting rolls. The Republicans do, because the Republican Party is the party of rich people. She says, "It is unsurprising, in light of the history of such purge programs, that Ohio's supplemental process has disproportionately affected minority, low-income, disabled, and veteran voters." She gives an example. In Hamilton County, quote, "In Hamilton County, African-American majority neighborhoods in downtown Cincinnati had 10% of their voters removed due to inactivity since 2012, as compared to only 4% of voters in suburban majority white neighborhoods." She says low voter turnout rates, again, I'm quoting from a Supreme Court dissent by Justice Sotomayor, "low voter turnout rates, language access problems, mail delivery issues, inflexible work schedules, and transportation issues, among other obstacles, make it more difficult for many minority, low-income, disabled, homeless, and veteran voters to cast a ballot or to return a notice, rendering them particularly vulnerable to unwarranted removal under Ohio's supplemental process." And then she goes on to point out that the right-wingers on the court don't disagree with anything she just said. They're just going to do this anyway, right? They're not even acknowledging that the National Voting Rights Act was passed to stop this kind of behavior. Here's how she says it in her polite language. "Neither the majority nor Ohio meaningfully dispute that the supplemental process disproportionately burdens these communities." Right? Ohio's, yeah, sure, what we're doing is going to disproportionately hurt African-Americans, Hispanics, low-income white people. It's going to disproportionately hurt those groups, disabled people and veterans. Ohio says it. Sure. Yeah. And so did the lawyers who were representing this right-wing think tank that funded this lawsuit. They all agree. Yeah, sure. That's going to be the outcome. She concludes, in concluding that the supplemental process does not violate the National Voting Rights Act, the majority does more than just misconstrue the statutory text. It entirely ignores the history of voter suppression against which the NVRA was enacted. It upholds a program that appears to further the very disenfranchisement of minority and low-income voters that Congress set out to eradicate. Our democracy rests on the ability of all individuals, regardless of race, income, or status, to exercise their right to vote. Communities that are disproportionately affected by unnecessarily harsh registration laws should not tolerate. Here's a call to action from a justice of the Supreme Court. Communities that are disproportionately affected by unnecessarily harsh registration laws should not tolerate efforts to marginalize their influence in the political process, nor should allies who recognize blatant unfairness stand idly by. Today's decision forces these communities and their allies to be even more proactive and vigilant in holding their states accountable and in working to dismantle the obstacles they face in exercising the fundamental right to vote. She gets it. We all get it. The Republicans get it. You know, this is Paul Weyrich. You know, I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by the majority of voters in the United States. They never have been. In fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down. 1980, the guy helping run Ronald Reagan's campaign. And then you put Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, and surprise, surprise, Reagan's strategy becomes the law of the land. We'll be back with your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls after this. And welcome back. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Professor Tom, it's been a while. I've been off the grid, man.
It has been.
First breath of fresh air. Boy, you was venting, man. Now let's talk about history a little bit. I want to touch on a few things. Between the period of 1918, November 1918, when the whole on the Western Front.
Oh, you can't, Rick, you can't use language like that. And I'm sorry, Rick, I gotta dump you. You can't talk like that on the air. And, you know, we'll carry on here. My apologies to anybody who might have been offended by Rick's comment. Michael in Snohomish, Washington. Hey, Michael, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Yeah, well, after your last rant, in Washington we vote by mail, so you know if you've been caged. You don't get a ballot in the mail.
Right. Or you can suspect you've been caged.
Yeah. Yeah. But if collusion is proved, is Donald Trump's presidency invalid? And would all his accomplishments be voided, such as Gorsuch, Zinke, and Pruitt?
Unfortunately, there's no precedent for that, and there's no provision for that in the Constitution. So I'm guessing that the worst that could happen would be that he would be impeached, and I don't think that that his party will allow that to happen. Because the removal from office requires the two-thirds vote in the Senate, and it's been tried twice with Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, and didn't work either time. Now, you know, it's clear to me that what Trump has done, you know, just the stuff that we know about, is worse than what Richard Nixon did. But, you know, like I said before, Richard Nixon did not have Fox News and, you know, broadcasting from the White House lawn this morning. Sinclair Broadcasting and the whole, you know, right-wing media machine, he did not have that. And Trump does, so I'm very concerned about it. But, you know, in terms of reversing everything, the way to reverse it all, Michael, is to elect a supermajority of Democrats to the Senate and a majority of Democrats to the House of Representatives, and then in 2020 elect a Democrat to the White House. And we shouldn't be waiting for Robert Mueller to show that, you know, to the world and to the Republican Party that Donald Trump is a horrible criminal or any of that kind of stuff, or that his election was illegitimate, for that to happen. Democrats need to be building a strong case saying we are the party of American values. We are the party of the American dream. We are the party of Medicare for all. We are the party of, you know, education for all, free education for all. We are the party of good jobs, a higher minimum wage, and the right to unionize. That's and we are the party of inclusion. We are the party that embraces people rather than divides people based on everything from gender identity to race. Makes sense, Michael?
Yeah, I joined my local Democratic Party and became a PCO. And
oh, that's great. In Snohomish, Washington, what was involved? You show up at the meeting and you wanted to become a precinct committee person. You got 10 seconds here to tell us about it, Michael.
All you have to do is go to the county auditor and sign up during the week of filing, and if you're unopposed, you're it.
Wow. And that's what you did, and that's how it worked.
And if you're opposed, then you show up on a ballot, and you're voted on.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a member of any particular party, but you do say, I want to be a PCO for the Democratic Party, or I want to be an independent PCO.
Right. Very interesting. Michael, thank you very much.
Whatever.
Good on you. Thank you, and thanks for listening to KBCS. Appreciate the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Dave, in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, since it's Anything Goes Friday, I was wanting to ask about some, or if you even have a take on some recent environmental destruction news.
Right.
There's one that was particularly interesting because there was a lot of conservative commentary on it. They've discovered organic molecules, organic compounds in the atmosphere of Mars.
Right.
And of course, you know, it's mainly methane. And of course, the right wingers are saying, oh, you know, these liberals are saying it's proof of life. You know, they don't understand that azoic processes also result in organic compounds. But nobody's mentioning that it does kind of validate the class rate gun theory, you know, that there is a criticality. There is a point where, you know, all the clathrates under the benthic layer of the ocean will release toxic amounts of methane. And also there is another report about the baobab trees of the savannas of Africa.
Right, they're going extinct.
They're all dying in mass. I mean, this is almost a living fossil.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and also the Antarctic... in fact, it's a story I was going to get into today. Now is as good a time as any. The Antarctic is warming radically faster over the last decade than it had, I think, three times faster than had been predicted and that it had been warming. And there was a friend of mine, Earl Katz, just sent me a clip of a massive calving, you know, falling away of a giant piece of a glacier, you know, in Antarctica. It's pretty remarkable. Dave, spot on. We've got a really serious problem with this. Thanks for the call. Antonio in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Antonio, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make the comment of how Republicans use scapegoats, minorities, demagoguery to distract from the real issues. And as us as Democrats, we can't engage in that. Oh, just calling them out in their pure racism. We have to combat the issue, the illegal immigrants or undocumented. The real effective way to go after them is to go after the employers, stop the opportunity for them to actually work.
Yeah. You know, I've been saying this forever. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem. And you just said it very well, Antonio. Thank you. Hey, Louise in Penn Valley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Louise, what's up?
Hello. My comment was just about how there is an issue with the media not holding Trump account for what he has done and telling the full extent of the damage. And I think that there is a behavior that he learned probably very, very early on in which he recognized the shame that very successful people have in being called out. And that's how he's been able to repeatedly escape guilt and accountability, because he understands that there are a whole bunch of people who allowed this to happen that do not want to be accountable at all.
I agree, and Louise, so, but I would add, I think you're looking at an abused and unloved child.
It starts from that. Yeah, but what's going on right now is an understanding that he has built and been allowed to grow on, based on the fact that he recognizes the shame of people of power.
Yeah, amen. Louise, we're hitting a break here. Very well said. Thank you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. Friday. And by the way, at 10 minutes before the hour, Luke Vargas will be calling in from Singapore with our news report for the day. And so just an FYI, and for those of you who are on hold, you know, when that time comes, you'll know what's up. Although Arthur will probably drop in and tell you. Otis in Yorktown, Virginia. Otis, you are on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'll try to hit them quickly. I'll put the names out there. Cheryl Eifel with the Legal Defense Fund is a good guest you could possibly have. The other one is Brian Stevenson with the Equal Justice Project with that Manchin Memorial. But
yeah.
I'd like to also say
Joe mentioned that Cheryl Eifel, I'm assuming that's Gwen's daughter, has a new book out. And
actually, it's a cousin. She runs the Legal Defense Fund for the NAACP.
Oh,
but I'd like to touch on something else, too.
Mm-hmm.
The televising of the Rodney King beating was a milestone in the media not sharing events immediately when they happen because they know that Americans are impulsive and reactive. And the other part is, I love the way basically you've tied in your whole 3 hours a day is based on something I did in college back in 75 at the University of Arizona, the Power Manifesto.
Mm.
People actually go through that. It's the most shared document I've used on social media because if you look at it, the past 40 years in this country is the Bible of what's going on.
You're right.
Right-wing millionaires use it to infiltrate colleges with the Koch brothers, to circumvent political representation through lobbyists and corporate personhood. And all of that is exactly what Lewis Powell talked about. And to give you an idea, I never knew who Lewis Powell was until I listened to some old black farmers talk about him in Yorktown, Virginia, where I am right now, because they had run into him. He was a staple in Richmond, Virginia. And
right.
You know the history of Richmond and the Confederacy and the whole
thing. Yeah, he was a lawyer who defended the white power structure, basically, in Virginia.
Exactly. And his whole thing was he was a firm believer in the manifest destiny and the lost cause.
Yeah.
These are people who worked in his home when he was a youngster. So I'm telling you that if people look at the Powell Manifesto, they'll find out it's a blueprint for everything we experienced, including the Mercers taking over Trump.
Yep.
Once they had stirred up all of the vitriol in the Republican Party. I love the work you do, and keep on doing it.
Thank you, Otis. I completely agree, and I wrote a book about this called The Crash of 2016, and tragically, publishers come up with titles, not authors. And it was a terrible title. I mean, the title should have been How Lewis Powell Set America on a Path of Destruction. And frankly, I wish they would reissue it. And in fact, I'd even go in and edit it a little bit to argue that. Because most of the book, I mean, the book, you know, opens with the Powell memo and then, you know, how this was put into place and what the economic as well as political consequences of it are. So, you need to get that out there. Al in Franklin Park, Illinois. Hey, Al, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I got a quick question here. Can you please advise on, here you're talking about a constitutional crisis. You know, this president of ours does something crazy. What would that look like in our world today?
If Donald Trump was to try to pardon himself, if he was to issue preemptive pardons against people who apparently collaborated with him in or members of his family in crimes, if Donald Trump was to fire the Assistant Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and replace him with His version of Robert Bork, the guy that Nixon brought in to fire Archibald Cox, if he was to do that, then, you would have a situation where it's conceivable that stuff could go to the Supreme Court, which would genuinely qualify as a constitutional crisis. I've said over and over again, though, I don't think that's how it's going to play out. I think pretty much Trump can get away with anything he wants right now. He said during the campaign that he could go out in Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody in the head and people would still support him. I'm increasingly believing that to be true. And he's using the tactics quote FDR of the dictators of Europe. He's using those tactics, those propaganda tactics, the big lie, you repeat it over and over and over again to numb us to the horrors that he and his administration are doing to our environment, to our economy, to minority groups inside the United States, to immigrants, right, et cetera. So that's my concern. Al, you raise a great question. Thank you for the call. Peter in Winter Haven, Florida. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was just thinking that there might be an easy way to argue why privatizing something is not a good thing. So think of a state-owned toll road, and let's say it costs $5 to cross it. You pay $5, you cross it, and then the money goes to the state, and then the state can disperse it however they want. And if, let's say, that gets privatized, so now that $5 go to the private corporation, and now they pay 20% corporate tax, and now only $1 goes to the state, and the other $4 don't.
Well, hang on just a second, Peter. The corporate tax is a tax on profits. It's an income tax. So they don't have to pay any tax at all if they can keep their profit to zero, if they simply, move all that money into salaries or into dividends to their stockholders.
Okay, yeah. So notwithstanding, basically, any government function that gets taken out of the kind of circulation and into the private hands, that means that gap will have to be filled up with the cuts and stuff, and we won't see any of that money that private corporations take over. And I think it can be applied to anything, VA hospitals, regular, just about anything. So I think if people easily make these arguments to Republicans and right-wingers, I think it's going to be a lot easier for them to see how privatizing something is not a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very well-made point. Thank you very much for that, Peter. I appreciate it. Janice in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. Hey, Janice, what's on your mind today? Janice? Oh, my. Janice is listening to her television. Let's try Tazio in Ithaca, New York. Am I saying that right, Tazio?
Yeah. You ask me that every time.
I'm sorry.
You always say it right.
Great.
Just go with your instinct.
Okay, what's on your mind?
I want to talk, in regards to North Korea, I want to talk about that piece of paper they signed.
Yeah.
They refer to it as a declaration of friendship, which certainly doesn't sound legally binding. So I want to know who's going to enforce this thing. Is it going to be the Senate, the Congress, the Pentagon?
There's nothing to enforce. Tazio,
yeah,
can go over to commondreams.org. They've got the whole document there. It's only two pages, and it's just a statement of principles, basically. We like each other. We're going to work toward, peace and happiness and all this kind of stuff. But there's literally nothing to enforce. Donald Trump got nothing in exchange for giving away, for elevating Kim to the status of world leader, and for stopping our military
optics,
exercises.
Right. It's just the whole optics of the situation.
Right.
Right. It's not. He didn't give anything away except for being friends with another dictator.
What Trump gave away was he's stopping our military exercises off the coast of the Koreas, and he says it's going to save us money.
Well,
but we spend that money anyway. I mean, he's going to scrap those airplanes. He's going to fire those soldiers and sailors. I don't think so.
That's my point. Did he give that away? Is any of the military spending going to change? Because
military spending won't change, but our coordination with South Korea to prepare for the possibility that North Korea might do what they did the last time we pulled out of South Korea, which is invade, which I think was in 48. Our ability to work with the South has been severely hampered by this decision that Trump made. Tazio, thanks for the call. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Tom. I've been thinking about this problem we have in the country with everybody believing Trump. And it all goes back to Fox and to the lack of no fairness doctrine, which I don't understand why anybody in the Democratic House, the members, don't do something about bringing it back. But I think that what we really need is to have someone do some type of forensic investigation into Murdoch and Fox TV and see where his, how did he get his citizenship, where is his money coming from, and who is paying him off to destroy the United States.
Wow. It's increasingly seeming in this what now when or .com or whatever that website is, this mashup that they did of Hannity reacting to Obama saying he talked to Kim versus Hannity reacting to Trump talking to Kim is just head spinning. And it really makes you think that this is now official state television. You know, we've got, you know, the Fox is like the press in North Korea. Norma, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back. We're going to check in with Luke at Talk Media News in about 4 minutes. Stick around. And welcome back. Jim, watching Free Speech TV in Los Angeles. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Professor Hartman. My goodness gracious. Jeez, oh, Pete, how the world gets so crazy.
Yeah.
Bunch
of rich people sat around and hatched a conspiracy back in the 50s and then again in the 70s, and that's how it got this crazy, Jim. And Chuck is up next, by the way.
Yes, and it was one of your listeners who was so right that even though you disagreed with her, it was that we didn't jump into politics because life was so good then. Back in the 70s, we stopped the war, and then we stopped, you know, our politics. And the world changed, and now these octogenarians are, Jeff Sessions, is he immensely competent?
I think he entirely is. Being smart or having your wits about you, even in your 60s or 70s, and I'm not sure how old Jeff Sessions is, but he's one or the other, has nothing to do with whether or not you're a sociopath.
I know it's 70s, but it's that he is openly, we're America, you know, we don't take children away from their mothers.
Well, we apparently do now, Jim, and I agree with you. I think this is a complete violation of the principles, and Jim, thank you, you've said it so well, of the principles upon which this country was founded. Or at least some of those, the better of those principles, shall we say, and certainly what we have come to stand for over the years. Chuck in New Haven, Connecticut. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I think you're fantastic. You're one of the best patriots, and you're amazing. You're amazing, but we need more people like you. But I have a couple of good ideas. One of them is public political debating centers. We need them all across the country because too many people are really stupid and don't know enough about opposition's opinions. And
here's the problem with that, Chuck. If you look at, you know, I mean, Congress keeps taking these long weekends, right? They leave on Thursday, they come home, they come back on Tuesday so that they can go back to their district and have town hall meetings and meetings with their constituents. That's the theory. And they take these long, month-long vacations. I mean, Congress, about half the year, almost half the year, they're not there. And they go home into their home districts. The Democrats, pretty much right across the board, are holding town halls in which, in venues where citizens can, as you described, stand up and debate those representatives or lobby them, essentially. The Republicans, almost to a person, are refusing to do that. They are not doing town halls because what they find is that when they get challenged in these town halls, the video of it gets out and it makes them look bad or embarrasses them. And what they are doing is so criminal, is so destructive to the values of this country, is so destructive to the planet that we live on, that they are not able or willing to defend it in public. They just can't. And so, you know, you're not, you know, if you had public debate centers, Republicans wouldn't show up for that either.
Tom, I think we need to teach how to be the best American on TV, radio, internet, schools, and also how to properly interact and against prejudice, which is destroying this country.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do with this program, Chuck, but I agree with your sentiment, and I'd love to see, you know, more civics being taught in our country, for example, and being taught in a rational way rather than like, you know, Texas did with their school books where they took out Thomas Jefferson and replaced him with Rush Limbaugh. Seriously. Thanks a lot, Chuck. I appreciate the call. It's great to hear from you. We'll be back. We'll be right back. Let's check in with Luke Vargas and talk media news, find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us, I believe still from Singapore, is the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News. You can follow him as The Courier over on Twitter. Luke Vargas. Luke, you are still in Singapore?
Yeah, pretty much everyone's left who was here for the summit on Tuesday. I mean, the big advantage of kicking around, though, has been to be on the same time zone as Mike Pompeo as he sort of continues to pitch whatever was agreed to on Tuesday to our allies and to China, whose policy President Trump really seems to have embraced here. And I think the real thing to watch as we sort of fit together different storylines here is, how do these tariffs that Trump is saying he's going to place on China today, how are they responded to by China? I mean, the thinking really has been that what President Trump did on Tuesday was reach onto the foreign policy shelf. And there's a big red box there with the red flag of the Chinese Communist Party with some yellow stars. And Trump basically took that off and adopted it as U.S. foreign policy, being the freeze for freeze program in exchange for North Korea freezing its nuclear and ballistic missiles and then their tests, that the United States would stop military cooperation with South Korea. I mean, that is such a central Chinese request about how to view this.
The Chinese crisis have been pitching this for more than a decade.
They have been. And I will, I'll mention that in a story on January 18th in the Wall Street Journal of this year, there was an article that asked 50 different people who had face-to-face meetings with President Trump the year before to talk about sort of what kind of communications, tactics they would recommend to break through and get a hold of the president. And in the course of that article, it didn't get a whole lot of attention at the time. But a few people said that basically this notion of the freeze for freeze was not pitched to Trump by the Chinese, but by President Putin last year at the G20. It's only an article that people are sort of looping back to now and saying,
This was publicly known back when Putin pitched this to Trump.
It was known in January. I think the meeting, I can't put a date on it, but it was maybe July last year in Hamburg. But at least in January, we knew that there was perhaps even a Russian provenance to this idea as well. So the question is going to be, does China maybe not quite mirror the retaliatory tariffs that they have enacted in response to past protectionist moves by Trump recently? Do they not really cut the U.S. any slack because of us having come around to their position? So that's something to watch. And I would also say, I think something we are, I guess, not surprisingly seeing divergent interpretations of is this one line in the thing that was agreed to on Tuesday. And the U.S. and North Korea really do appear to be interpreting what it is they agreed to on paper differently. Now, what's on paper isn't the end of the world, right? I mean, it's very possible a purposely vague language was put down, and maybe that's good. But we are seeing from KCNA, the North Korean broadcaster, that they believe that they have agreed to step-by-step and simultaneous actions with the United States to take apart the nuclear program. And that's probably the only thing that is realistically going to happen. But Mike Pompeo, as he goes around to South Korea and talked to the Japanese yesterday and is in China today, keeps insisting that not only are the sanctions not going to come down until the nuclear program is fully dismantled, but that they might even throw in human rights too. And so, again, it just suggests that short of actually giving us greater clarity about the process, the sort of seemingly impossibly vague language that was signed on Tuesday may have actually complicated this process more by sort of giving each country a part of a sentence that they can point to and say it completely backs up what their particular view is. And one would have hoped that the sort of treaty or whatever we're going to call this agreement language would have been much more concrete.
This is why these things are typically negotiated before the leaders show up.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were parts of it that were, but as we talked about on Tuesday, it does seem there were parts that came together only at the last second. And my big question still coming out of this meeting, something I wish I had a chance to ask President Trump, because I feel like a lot of reporters spend too much time asking questions about policy, like big heady stuff that Trump doesn't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And what we would have been really nice to know is, you know, he said the rapport was strong. He said they were making deals right up until even after this agreement had been signed. The White House had hotel rooms and security through several days this week. Why did they pack up and leave? Was it Kim who felt like he'd bargained away too much? Did someone cut off Trump and said, dude, you're giving away everything? We need to end this now. I think that is odd to me because I think the
who made that decision?
We don't know. But it does seem like the language that was sort of hastily agreed to here has the possibility of becoming a liability as opposed to sort of unlocking further progress. So that is another big
a liability for the process as a whole or simply for the United States?
I think for the United States. It's just, you know, you could tell there was a reporter who was talking to Mike Pompeo on the flight out of Singapore the other day, and the transcript came out the following day, in which he just gets irate. I mean, this person is pressing him, saying, you know, saying all these things have been agreed to. What are you referring to in this treaty? President right. Trump himself also seems to think it's much longer and more detailed than it really is. There are divergent opinions already about this, and we're just several days in.
Amazing. Luke Vargas, The Courier on Twitter. Luke, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. And thank you for being with us today. Another fascinating day, and I'm sure Monday will be another one. So, you know, I have a wonderful and blessed weekend. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you getting out there and getting active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.